This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. UCF's Business Incubation Program is partnering with Veterans Florida's Entrepreneurship Program. It's a course designed to help veterans push through some of the challenges that face any business owner trying to turn an idea into reality. We last spoke to Ricardo Garcia from UCF's Business Incubation Program back in May last year. He joins us again. Thanks for being here, Ricardo.
Thank you for having me.
And John Burns joins us too. His company is called Eagle 6. It provides technology services to the defense sector. John, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you for inviting me.
Ricardo, let me start with you. What's changed in the 12 months or so since we talked to you about the UCF Business Incubator and what you are doing to help mentor and help veterans get their businesses off the ground?
Yes, absolutely. So we had another successful year, our second year in partnership with Veterans Florida. We, different from the first year, this year we had a smaller cohort. We wanted to focus on helping veterans that were a little bit further ahead within 6 months of launching or have launched their business. So we scaled back from the 27 veterans that we graduated the first year to 15 veterans that we graduated this last course. And all of them are within 6 months of launching or have launched their business. And so that was the biggest difference of the first year to now.
As far as kind of tracking what happens to these entrepreneurs once they launch, you know, if you look at just in general, entrepreneurship is a bit tricky, right? A lot of businesses which get launched fail within the first year or the first 2 years. What about veteran-owned businesses and veteran-owned startups? What do those numbers tell you?
Yeah, so in the incubator, we help invert that success failure rate. I know that generally speaking, after 5 years of a year being in business, 80% of them are not businesses anymore. Mm-hmm. With the incubator, it's a little bit the inverse of that. So 5 years after they launched, 20% fail, 80% of them are still in business. And that's generally speaking, I think the Kauffman Foundation had a study in that. Mm-hmm. So we see something similar with those that engage with us, but continue working with us throughout the years. I mean, it's this course is great, but it's a course to just kind of get the fundamentals in front of them, help them understand the Lean Startup methodology, help them define their value propositions, figure out their customer segments, validate their customers. Help them structure the business for success, right? But we want to continue engaging with them throughout the years.
That is a pretty extraordinary statistics, though, Ricardo. I mean, turning that success-failure rate for entrepreneurship on its head, and you're talking about veteran entrepreneurs here, what do you think the key is?
Well, I think for veteran entrepreneurs, their key, some of the skills that they bring to the table are key to their success, right? Things that the military instilled within us. So things like attention to detail, that mission-driven mentality, getting the mission done, the teamwork and collaboration, the leadership. I think those are all essential skills that entrepreneurs should have, and this is where veterans have an advantage.
Mm-hmm. Well, John, this is probably a good point to bring you into this conversation. You have a company that you started, and I understand you're a graduate of this program too. Tell me about your involvement in the program and
sure.
What you do with your company.
So my company was launched in 2012, so I would probably classify myself as I'm through the startup phase and then in the second stage growth. But my involvement with the Veterans Florida program was being part of that inaugural class that had a mixture of businesses that were, say, in the 2 to 3 years and made it through what we call the valley of death, that first 1 to 3 year where you really got to, and that's mainly when the failures happen, if you're through that, mm-hmm. but you're then trying to propel your company and grow your company. So Veterans Florida, to me, has been a constant interaction with them since I graduated to try to capitalize on the resources that they have, the expertise they have, because we all have problems. Every day is a new challenge for an entrepreneur, and sometimes the best thing to do is reach out to those that have mentored you in the past and get their advice, counsel, and then you've got to ultimately make the business decision. Mm-hmm. And I try to mentor other startup businesses myself because I'd like to pay it forward for those that helped me get to where I am.
So give us the elevator pitch for people in the civilian world.
So our company is a technology company focused predominantly on command and control systems and cybersecurity. Mm-hmm. There's a great growth area in the cybersecurity, and we provide turnkey solutions for those challenging problems that businesses have to help them become more efficient and ultimately provide cost savings to them.
How have the last couple of years been? Because cybersecurity has been in the news a lot lately.
It's a growth industry. And I predominantly first got into it when I was in the military, running a command and control center in Kuwait as we were going into Iraq on the initial invasion. So to me, it kind of was a hand-in-hand system. Our biggest challenge right now in cybersecurity on the government side is finding qualified people that have the top secret clearances and they also have the cyber credentials. Mm-hmm. For somebody wanting to get into a field right now that's out there, this market will only, who knows how far it's gone because every mm-hmm. day it's a new attempt to get to that.
Now, when you say that it's a challenge finding the right people, is that because there's not enough graduates coming
through? Well, I think there's not enough graduates, and then there's a combination because I'm predominantly in the government top secret space is the security clearances that are required for that mm-hmm. and also the credentials. So it's a combination of the two. I actively recruit retired military or somebody that's coming off active duty that has that clearance and then, try to get them the credentials they have to fill the positions with. Mm-hmm. But it's a real challenge right now out there.
Are all of your staff veterans?
85% are veterans. That was the, when I put the company together, the vision, Eagle 6 was my call sign as a aviation commander. So, I relate to that and the vision, the mission, and the core capabilities come out of that. So, yes, that is a tremendous growth opportunity for new folks out there. Predominantly in the government space, it's the security clearances that you need that maybe on the commercial sector, I don't necessarily need them to have that, but mm-hmm. they need to have the cyber, the security credentials.
Ricardo, tell me a little more about the grant. I understand it's been trimmed back a little bit this year, so you are sort of working through some challenges with the incubation program and sort of leveraging the money that you have to make this program work, right?
It's been trimmed a little bit. We're still going to be able to fulfill our mission, which is to empower and support veteran entrepreneurs through business guidance, education, and mentorship. And the way we're doing that is by doing these advanced cohorts. The past 2 years, we've only had one cohort per year. Our mission this year is to have two cohorts, one which will be in the fall starting in September, and then another one sometime in the spring. We're still determining the date, but it'll likely be late January, early February for those advanced cohorts. We're also going to have a monthly networking type event for any veteran out there in the community who would like to engage. Veteran entrepreneurs, they can be at the idea stage. They don't have to have a company or anything like that. We'll also have bi-monthly workshops open for any veterans as well on certain topics, whether it's legal, whether it's accounting or sales and marketing. Mm-hmm. That's what the mission of those workshops will be.
And how are you going to staff them? Where are you going to get the expertise from?
So we have a pretty robust entrepreneurial ecosystem that has been growing since the incubator launch. Dr. Tom O'Neill launched this back in 1999. And since then, we've built this robust entrepreneurial ecosystem here in Central Florida. So we have a lot of resource providers and partners, right? Mm-hmm. So we're UCF is known as America's Partnership University. So we really emphasize that. We always look for new partners, whether it's a resource provider, whether it's potential mentors, or other types of partners. We're always open to those. And mm-hmm. One thing is that we've seen and we're very grateful for is that veteran entrepreneurs that have been successful, that have gone through the UCF Business Incubator, they're coming back now and giving back and getting involved some way, whether it's, to be a mentor or sponsor, lunches and that type of thing. We really, really value that, and we're grateful for that. And I think as we move forward with this program, we're going to see a lot more of that. So,
John, I guess you're an example of that. You're coming back and trying to play it forward, as you say, pay it forward, rather.
Absolutely, pay it forward. Belong on the executive board of the Florida Association of Veteran-Owned Businesses that was started right here in Orlando in 2012, and we now have a Space Coast chapter. So it's in a, you know, it's like the Chamber of Commerce for veterans, and there's a lot of interacting that we do with Veterans Florida and other different resources that are here. I'm a current UCF incubator company myself. I'm in my third year there, and just the amount of resources that they provide to me as a business owner allows me to then use those resources saved through that to launch into other endeavors. Mm-hmm. So in 2019, our big move is we're going to move out of the government sector into the commercial sector and kind of focus on healthcare, small surgical centers, 50 and below here in Central Florida that are a real target right now for a lot of cyber penetrations. We're launching that in 2019, and a lot of the planning that has gone into that, I've leveraged all the resources from the incubator program, Veterans Florida Entrepreneur, to kind of put that plan together.
Before we finish, John Burns, I want to just ask you, what is one thing you wish you'd known before you started your company that you think other veteran entrepreneurs starting out would benefit from?
Well, I will tell you, Ricardo and I just had this conversation come up the hallway, is I wish I'd have been a little bit more skilled in the financials of the company and cash flow and what a balance sheet looked like. You know, I'd had background of running a pretty large business in the military, a flying hour program, but I really didn't have those skills when I first started my company. And that's what I talk when I kind of share my lessons learned with new veterans getting started. I says, really get into the financials. If you don't understand the financials, then get with somebody that can help you, because that is the key to being successful. If you don't know the financials and being able to make trade-offs with the resources you have, you're going to struggle. And then just persevere. We all go through cash flow problems, and I went through it at my 2 to 4 year period, and you know, beating payroll and everything like that. But if you can get through that, it's good. But I think if anything, that was the one thing that I wish I had a little bit more prepared in terms of launching my company.
Ricardo, what's one bit of advice you would give to veterans looking to start a new business?
I would say leverage your resources, right? I would tell them, you know, you have skills that the military has taught you that perhaps you don't realize. Realize that you have those skills. You know, you have that attention to detail, that mission-driven mentality. So leverage that, and also leverage the resources that are at your disposal. There are tons of organizations in the community, so get involved and leverage those resources. So that's one of the things that we're here to do, you know, is help those vets succeed in their entrepreneurial endeavors.
Well, Ricardo Garcia is with the UCF Business Incubation Program. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. I just want to add one thing. We have opened the applications now, so any veterans that would like to participate in the program, they can visit our website at incubator.ucf.edu/veterans.
We're also joined by John Burns. His company is called Eagle 6. It provides technology services to the defense sector. Thank you, John.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity to be here today.
Still to come on Intersection, a summer writing camp for kids. One challenge facing the tutors at Page 15, how do you get the kids to put down the phone and write? Intersection's back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. You've heard of the summer slide, when kids slip back on reading, math, and other skills over the long summer break. One Orlando summer camp aims to stop the slide for young writers. Now in its 11th year, Page 15 in Paramore has grown from serving a handful of students to over 200 this year. From the education desk this week, we revisit a conversation with Page 15's executive director, Julia Young, and director of educational programs, Paul Driscoll. Young began by explaining how the program's grown in the decades since it started.
Wow. So in 10 years, we started the program in 2008. I think we had about 40 kids, and that was pretty standard. I think, you know, we'd jump by about 20 a couple years. We've exploded in the last couple years. So it continues to grow. The interest continues to grow. Word of mouth continues to grow. So we're really excited about it.
Now, is it a week by week program? Is there a goal at the end of it? What do they get by the end of the summer if they stay through the whole thing?
Yeah. So it's a week by week program. So each week serves a different age group, really because the kids are kind of at different levels in their own, you know, education and interest and themes and stuff. And so each week is a, you know, second, third, fourth, and fifth, and we go all the way up until high school. And they come in to learn how to write a book, write different parts of the story, character development. And at the end of the week, they go home with their own published book. They get to meet an author. They get a book signing. It's been pretty incredible.
Mm-hmm. Who are some of the authors you had?
So we had Jenny Torres Sanchez was one of our authors for our high schoolers. We had, I'm forgetting
James
all of our,
Pawnee James from Pawnee. Author of Framed, and he was on the Sunshine State Book Club this year and this summer, and he's a local, so we're really happy to have him, and really great spirit, good with our middle school students.
So, Paul, how do you get these authors? Do they come to you? Do they know about the program? Do you reach out to them?
Well, we're fortunate in that we've been doing this for 10 years locally, and we also have a sister organization called Borough Press who has a lot of connections and contacts with local authors and then even beyond. So we have those initial contacts, and you know how that works. Contacts beget contacts, and so we end up having a nice little pool of a variety of authors for all different ages. We had an illustrator come in for a children's book actually this year, which was a little different but similar process, and that's really what we're all about is process.
Mm-hmm. So it's not just writing. It's also some illustration as well.
Sure. Yeah. We don't like to put restrictions on that creative process. You know, the kids are coming to us. They're all each unique thinkers. They're all dynamic and interesting. And some of them really write well in prose. Others of them think visually. And so we try to adapt programming so that we can suit those needs. Some kids even create like a graphic novel over the course rather than a straight novel.
Mm-hmm.
So we try to work towards their strengths and interests and what really brings them joy as a creator.
How do you get kids to put down their phones or their iPads and write? What's the key?
Oh, my goodness. That's a great question. If I had the answer to that, I'd probably be worth a lot more money. These phones, they're ubiquitous now, and the kids all have them, and they're getting them at a younger age. And I've been a person that's taught coming-of-age students for many years. I've taught well over 2,000 middle school students. And so I've seen the change over time. And yeah, you know, on one hand, it's a wonderful tool. I mean, it's incredible to talk to a kid and be talking about medieval times and reach in my pocket and find some more information about medieval times. But then there's conversely is how much it draws as a kind of a time and energy suck. Mm-hmm. You know, people can get stuck in their phones and kind of be compulsive about it. And when we take their phones away, it's funny. You'll hear the kids talk about it using the language of addiction and that withdrawal and how much they're suffering for not having access to their phones.
Mm-hmm. Now, you serve a range of ages. Are you finding phones and electronic devices are kind of seeping into younger kids now as far as...
Of course, yeah. Because, I mean, that's the oracle. They see the older kids doing that, and that's where a lot of social happens. That's the hardest part. There's so much social, you know, interaction happening inside of that machine that's where you go to be social, and all these kids want to connect with other kids. And so that seems to be the platform that is most easily accessible and most available to them, unfortunately, 24 hours a day. So it's hard to escape.
So at the start of the day for summer camp, it's like stick your phone in this bucket and you get it back at the end of the day. How's that work?
Not quite. We don't want to be like the warlords over there. I mean, these are tools at the end of the day, and they can use them responsibly. And I think that's our biggest role is to teach them to use these tools responsibly and not to use them as a distraction. But so we try to encourage that and remind them that we're not here to be spending time playing games or managing our social media presence. We're here to create original and unique art that is from their own experiences. And the kids, that's what they want. They want to create and they want to express themselves. And so it's not hard to get them to move away from their phones when you're offering something like that.
Julia, I guess the flip side of that is, you know, smartphones are a tool for creation, right? I mean, you can write a lot of stuff, and kids generate thousands and thousands of words in the form of text every year. I'm wondering if you've seen that sort of change the way kids write in the last 10 years.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that it kind of gives us an opportunity to talk about audience. You know, I mean, text speak is a very real language and it's appropriate for some audiences. You know, when you're talking through text to your friends or your family, you know, maybe that's appropriate. So I think it's just opened up, you know, when we talk about creative writing and you talk about voice and dialogue, you know, you talk about who you're speaking to, who's reading your work, you know, so The way you might write an email to your professor or your teacher or your letter to your grandmother is very different than the way that you would send a text to your friends. And so, we have that conversation.
Mm-hmm. Just emphasizing purpose and audience, you know, and that's what you have to be considerate about, because this is a language that exists. A language evolves over time, as we all know, and text language and quite frankly, emoji language is something that they have great command over. And we don't want to say there's not a place for that. I use it. I'm sure we all in here use it. But there is a time and place for those things. And if they think in their mind when they sit down to create a writing, what's my purpose and for whom am I writing? Who's my audience? And a lot of the decisions that you make along the line of creating writing can be guided by those simple questions.
Mm-hmm. I also think that, you know, when they see powerful sentences and when they see powerful usage of words and really beautiful, crafted, well-crafted sentences and paragraphs, I mean, they get it. These kids, they see it. And when you read it out loud to them, you know, one of the exercises we do at the Young Writers Summer Camp at Page 15 is a first sentence exercise. And so, you know, we talk about, we reference all of these really great first sentences in books and, you know, and kind of use examples of, you know, what would be a terrible way to introduce a story to a great story. And they see it and they feel it and they want to create that.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. We're with Julia Young and Paul Driscoll from the Page 15 Language and Arts Program based in Paramore. And that's the key, right, Julia? Sometimes you only get the power of the language when you hear it read aloud.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, we talk about that a lot. You know, I mean, language is not just in written form or just reading it or writing it. It's very much, it's your voice. It's who you are. It's how you command language. I mean, it's all of that.
And a lot of times just the reading aloud, that's an editing process in and of itself. I know you as a creator and writer, if you're writing silently to yourself, you know what you're saying, but you really only hear it for the first time. Mm-hmm. As an audience when it's read aloud,
right,
by someone else or even for yourself. And it's amazing how many mistakes kids will pick up on their own just by hearing the way it sounds. You know, it's similar to, you might not be a musician, but if you heard someone play a series of notes and one was out of place, you would be like, there's something wrong with that note. I don't know what it is. I don't know what the scale is, but that's sour. That's mm-hmm. just not right. And so for us, a big part of what we're doing is to train the ear, you know, because there's so many rules of grammar and so many exceptions. And English is this wonderful mutt of a language mm-hmm. that it's actually easier and more efficient for you to train your ear to what sounds right. And, you know, 89%, 90% of the mistakes that you make, you'll find just by hearing it.
Mm-hmm. Sometimes those bum notes can be kind of beautiful in themselves, though, right? I mean, you're wearing a T-shirt saying, I love rough drafts.
I am, yeah.
Sometimes the beauty is in just the process and kind of making mistakes and finding things out as you go.
Oh, it's music to my ears, what you're saying, because that's what it is for us. It's not, you know, we love to celebrate the final product, and we really do a great job producing books for all different kinds of kids. But for us, it's the process and practicing that discipline. And so the more that you're doing that, the more volume you have in creating through that writing process, the easier it becomes. And then when called upon in the future, they've done this so many times, it's like a second nature. And much mm-hmm. like the work that you're doing, you're creating with language. And when you first started doing it, maybe it didn't come as quickly or as easily. But as you do it more and more and more, it just becomes more natural and more of a part of who you are.
And the editing process, I think, is just something that they don't really get to really spend a lot of time with in school, you know. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, there's a lot to get through in school. And so generally, you know, the editing process for kids is they write a paper, they turn it in, it gets a bunch of red marks on it, they get it handed back. There's no investment in it. They toss it in the paper or they fix those mistakes because they know that that's what they should do. But involving them in that process and that editing process has been one of the things I think Page 15 does best. And mm-hmm. I think that's really where we get kids excited about what they're writing. There's an investment and a pride in what they're creating.
That's the biggest thing I've noticed throughout my career. And what I've learned, what was frustrating as an educator, a teacher of language arts, is to put all the time into writing these comments on these final papers and to
right.
have them look at the number that was on the top or the letter grade and basically, you know, put it to the side. And I'm hurt because I'm like, what about all these great comments that I wrote for you? Didn't you see? Mm-hmm. Then I said, okay, forget this. And we did essentially an inverted model where we conference with everything. We'll do a pre-writing conference, talk about ideas, kick it around to talk about what we need to, questions that we need to answer, research that needs to be done. And then we'll meet throughout the process. There isn't just a final turning something in. It's like, we're going to talk about this all the way through because for us, the process is everything. Rough drafts are everything. That's why we love them, because it's when we get to really craft. We get to play around with sentences and word choices and organization. And that's the joy of creating and writing. It's not necessarily the final. The final, you're almost a little sad. It's over. You know, put it away. It's just like ending a great book. You know, it was a great book and you got to the end of it, but then you suddenly were like, oh, well, it's over now. I don't have it anymore.
Paul Driscoll, what about the process of editing kids, though? Because do you have to be a little more gentle than you would with, I don't know, older students or people who sort of know that it's not personal if you say this is not the way it should sound?
Yeah, that's the greatest challenge, because for us, we're trying to create a culture. We work really hard to not be involved. That sounds weird as a teacher, but I want the kids to be able to work independently. I also recognize that I'm not the keeper of all language. It's not my role to keep language for everyone. But that communities do that, and their community themselves do that. And so we try to create an atmosphere where they feel safe. They feel like they'll be treated with dignity and respect by all members of the community. And then by creating that safe atmosphere, they start to have a more of a willingness to share. And this happens gradually, but they hear other kids share, and then another one, and then another one. And then gradually, you've created a culture where people have a willingness to put themselves out there because they know they're going to get valuable feedback, both praise and criticism that's necessary to advance their art, which is always been the role of the critic.
And I think authors, introducing the kids to the published authors, that's really definitely always something that I think that they get from them as well. You know, Ethan Long is a local illustrator and author here in Orlando, and he has a great little lesson for the kids about, you know, the first time that he turned in a book, he was so proud, and then the editor comes and he goes and cries in the closet for a little bit, and then, you know, gets back out there and makes those changes. And that's part of it, you know. I mean, that's what it takes to, you know, if you're really going to put your work out there, if you're really going to be a, you know, a published author or something. And so that's just a great lesson that I think the people who have been through that experience.
But it is, it's hard for the kids, and because it's your voice, you know, putting your voice out there is very personal. And to get criticism, maybe negative feedback about that, it feels like a personal attack. So to get past that and to say, this is just about helping you to be better, helping you communicate your message more clearly for this audience. And so we celebrate that exchange, because getting them outside of themselves and sharing with other people is really how we start to cultivate that great culture.
It's tough for adults too, right? I mean, editing is tough on the creator, no matter what age you are.
Well, it gets harder. You know, it's like anything. It's much harder to teach an older person, I guess, to play golf than it is for a young person, right? You just say, oh, hit the ball, and they say, okay. Well, we all think about it, and we're all measuring everything. But what we love about it, and we're teaching middle school this year, and one of my favorite ages to work with, because they're burning so intensely bright with everything in their lives. Everything's on the surface, right? But they want to have a voice, and they want to flex their independence. And here it is. We're giving them the keys to that. It's like, we're not telling you what you have to write about. What are your experiences? What is your point of view on the issues of the world? What do you have in your heart and in your mind? How can we help you make that a reality?
Julia, talk to me about some of the partnerships you've got going at Page 15, because there's a lot of change happening in Paramore. Talk about that for a moment.
Yeah, well, I mean, a lot of the work that we do at Page 15 wouldn't be possible with some of the partners. But Paramore, we've been working in the Paramore community for 10 years. So we've been there since the beginning of 2008. And so, yeah, just the changes within the community, from the new soccer stadium that was just been built. We saw the Magic Entertainment Center and the Amway Center be built. Now to the brand new ACE school, which is the new preschool through eighth grade that was just built there. UCF is changing the entire neighborhood. The Creative Village is being built. So we've been there through a lot of these changes. And, you know, part of what we do is meet kids where they are. And so, you know, we're looking, you know, we've got established great partnerships with the Orange County Public School System. A lot of the teachers and administrators, we have a board member from that organization on our board. And so a lot of it is just communication, seeing what they do, seeing what their mission is. And I think what, you know, UCF is another incredible partner for us. We operated our 10th annual Young Writers Camp in the Create Center right across the street, and we're able to incorporate a lot of what they have in their building into our curriculum. And so, you know, we've done work with the Orlando City Soccer Foundation, you know, so I think that's what's really interesting about language and about creative writing. And, you know, we can really take that anywhere. You know, we can – we've done athletes training journals with some of the kids enrolled in the Orlando City Soccer after-school soccer clinics, you know. So there's partnerships means a lot to us. You know, we want to be able to take language and show kids that it's, you know, it's accessible in in any context, you know, whether they're playing soccer, whether they're learning about technology, how does storytelling, you know, work from the digital, you know, media format and, you know, with virtual reality.
Yeah,
and
how it applies to modern storytelling, because, you know, the Center for Emerging Media downtown in UCF, they're developing films, they're developing storylines for video games, and these, again, these processes are very much the same as that simple paper and pencil process that we all start with as writers. So being that we're not content driven, we're able to put ourselves into a variety of situations and use writing for a whole bunch of different ways. I mean, we've done therapeutic writing sessions for people, post-traumatic experiences, and again, like you said, the athlete's training journal. Like, we can think of a lot of different ways where we can harness the power of writing and the value of writing to support all kinds of different objectives and programs throughout Central Florida.
Mm-hmm. And part of that is, you know, we've had to adapt and be adaptable because of the changes that the community in which we work sees. You know, I mean, there's just, I mean, just from transportation issues to where the kids are going to school to, I mean, there's so much change there.
Well, that's the joy too, though, of having now finally a community school. I mean, the Paramore neighborhood hasn't had their own school, frankly, since desegregation. And so now that we have a central place where they're going to have those foundational needs met, you know, of sometimes it's simple things, being fed and having clothing and having shelter and having security. Once you have that platform, that foundation built in, then we can start working on some of these other things. But many of these kids have been working at such a deficiency for so long, it is really challenging for them to even get a foothold on the rungs or the ladder to success.
Well, Paul Driscoll is the Educational Programs Director with Page 15. Thank you so much, Paul.
Thank you for having us.
And Julia Young, the founder and executive director of Page 15. Julia, thank you as well.
Thank you so much.
And that interview first aired on Intersection in August 2017. Up next, animal shelters are getting creative with social media to boost the pet adoption rate. But it's not just dogs and cats. Lake County's shelter has a surplus of pot-bellied pigs. So how do shelters deal with the summertime menagerie? Intersection's back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Animal shelters typically see an influx of dogs and cats in summer, dogs especially after the July 4th holiday when fireworks can scare the family pet into running away. But those aren't the only animals filling up the shelters. For more, we're joined by Whitney Boylston and Diane Summers. Whitney Boylston is the director of the Lake County Office of Animal Services. Whitney, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And we're also joined by Diane Summers. She's the program manager with the Orange County Animal Services. Thank you, Diane.
Yeah, always happy to be here.
So, Whitney, give us a sense of the kinds of animals that you see at the shelter in summer.
Well, we have, of course, an abundance of kittens during the summertime. It is kitten season, and it's in full swing. Of course, we also have a whole bunch of dogs needing homes, and we are just wrapping up our 4th of July rush. We have a significant uptick in our dog intake the week of the 4th of July because of the fireworks. Mm-hmm. And then for whatever reason, we have a whole lot of pigs down in Lake County right now. I've got 6 pigs up for adoption, and we are expecting a very large bird, perhaps an emu, on its way right now.
Yes, you were driving into the studio and you told me that you had the call about the emu or an ostrich on the loose.
Yes, they called it to let me know that there was an ostrich running down Highway 27.
Where would it have come from? Like a farm or a reserve or what?
You know, I guess we won't know until we find the owner, but a lot of people do have emu farms out in Lake County.
I should say, too, we are also joined by a couple of kittens from your shelter. Do you want to just introduce them, Whitney?
Sure. We have Jefferson and Hancock here with us. They came to us on the 3rd of July, and there were actually 4 kittens in their litter, and the other 2 have gone on to a different foster, and these 2 hang out with me all day.
What are the other two's names?
Quincy and Adams.
You must get a lot of animals. Do you give them all names, or do you sometimes run out of ideas?
Every animal gets a name in our shelter, and we do run out of inspiration after, you know, several thousand names. So we're always looking for suggestions from our visitors.
Mm-hmm. And what's the significance of the names of these kittens?
Well, these are Independence Day kittens. So, you know, we figured we would celebrate the Declaration of Independence.
Diane Summers, what kind of animals are you seeing an uptick in Orange County shelters?
So I feel like Orange County is a little bit different. We do not have any emus on the loose, to the best of my knowledge, nor a surplus of pigs, although that does sound like a very interesting menagerie there. We are primarily dogs and cats here in Orange County. And just as Whitney was saying, around 4th of July, we do receive an uptick in dogs, and really the summer as a whole, an increase in kittens.
Are you at capacity at the moment? Do you have some more space?
I would consider us at capacity. We may have one or two empty kennels at the moment, but we are receiving between 50 and 100 pets every day. So any empty kennels we have at this moment will undoubtedly be filled by the end of the day.
And give us a sense of what that represents as far as the proportion of animals you have there. Like what sort of space do you have available?
We have approximately 200 dogs in our care right now and 250 cats in our care.
Right.
So we are doing a promotion for the whole month of July where adoption fees are reduced to just $10, which includes the spay and neuter, the initial vaccines, and the microchip identification. And we are very eager to find placement for all of these adoptable animals.
And you're pretty active too on social media, right? Orange County Animal Services, you're sort of tweeting out pictures of these cute dogs and cats and trying to sell them to the public, essentially, not literally sell them, but just kind of present them as, you know, here's an option if you want a pet, come to the shelter.
Yes, we found a lot of success through social media, so we're very active on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. We found that it's a great way to reach new audiences and always promote, you know, the unique stories. Each animal, you know, has a little bit of personality or potentially has an interesting background, and social media gives us a way to highlight that.
Mm-hmm. Whitney, is that something that that the Lake County Animal Services is doing as well?
Absolutely. We've got a very active Facebook page, lots of followers. We encourage everybody to share the pictures of our pets because you never know who's going to fall in love.
So as Diane was saying, this is slightly different, I guess, if you're in a sort of major urban environment compared to where you are in Lake County, you are kind of going to have to take care of some of those other animals, like pigs, like potentially an emu here and there. So it's a different setup for the shelter, like, Do you have to sort of be a little bit flexible, expecting bigger animals to come in sometimes?
We do. We've got a livestock area, some paddocks, pens. Very often we have goats. Sometimes we end up with cows and horses and that kind of thing as well.
Mm-hmm.
We actually have a couple goats got adopted yesterday. We had a cow go home last weekend, so it's always something different.
And who would be adopting a goat?
You know, people love goats, so goat lovers out there, they come down to the shelter to meet their new family member.
They're quite voracious, though, right? They eat pretty much anything you put in front of them.
They do, but it's not always good for them, so we've got to be very careful about where we place them.
Mm-hmm. And I noticed, too, just sort of looking around online, every time you get one of these animals, you put a notice out there saying this animal was lost. Essentially, come and claim your pet or your animal, right?
Yeah, so actually that's governed by state statute. So if a animal comes to us with hooves, we have to do a public notice of impound. And so there's a process involved with that.
Mm-hmm. So just livestock.
Right, if it has hooves. Now, if it's a chicken, not so much.
And the ostrich would not be getting one of these notices.
No, it will not get a public notice of impound. However, we will be desperately seeking the owner.
Let me ask then Whitney Boylston about some changes in how people can acquire pets. Now, Lake County has a ban or a prohibition on stores that sell puppies, right? Tell me a little bit about that.
Sure. So back in May, we amended our Chapter 4 of our Lake County Code to prohibit the retail sale of pets, so dogs and cats. And we did not have any puppy stores. I noticed on my way in, you guys have a puppy store right next door to you. In Lake County, we haven't had that in a little while. So the only business that it really affected at the time was a gentleman at the flea market who was mm-hmm. selling puppies. It does not affect private sales, individuals, or, you know, breeders. So we're looking at that, but no more pet stores will be opening in Lake County.
And give me the rationale for that ban.
So the community really feels that we want to promote adoption and we do not want to support the puppy mill industry, inhumane breeding practices. And so by cutting these out of our community, then we're promoting our adoption of our adoptable pets because we have so many homeless pets that need you.
I'm sure there would be some pushback, though, from commercial pet retailers saying, look, we're not sourcing our animals from people who are breeding them, you know, in harmful situations, right? There's got to be some folks saying, well, we're doing this above the board, so you're cracking down on our business here.
Right, and so that is the criticism, that it's the legal sale of a legal product that we have prohibited in our county. Mm-hmm. However, like I said, we didn't have any at the time, so we didn't have that pushback. Other counties who have enacted these bans do have much more resistance when you have an existing business that you're effectively shutting down.
Diane Summers, this, I understand, is something that that Orange County is considering as well. Are you able to talk a little bit about what's happening in Orange County?
Yes, that's correct. It's something that's being discussed among our leadership, however, is not in effect at this point.
Mm-hmm. What's the process then? What has to happen next for something similar to be enacted in Orange County?
It would ultimately be the decision of our Board of County Commissioners as well as our mayor.
And is that something that the, you know, Animal Services thinks would be a good move? Would you then have more people coming in to adopt a pet from the shelter, do you think?
Well, we're always promoting adopting rather than breeding or buying. As Whitney said, pet overpopulation is a problem. It's something that we experience to a great deal here in Orange County. When you have 50 to 100 animals coming in a single day, obviously we do want adoption to be the first and foremost choice.
Are you seeing an uptick in numbers overall? Like, if you went back a few years, would you have been getting this many animals through your door in summer months, like 50 to 100 a day? Is that normal? Is that sort of trend going up?
Yes. So it is, unfortunately, normal for us. It's funny you ask that because I was actually looking at our June numbers for 2017 just yesterday, and it is almost on the mark. We received, I believe it was around 800 animals this past June, and around 800 the year prior. So we are experiencing a lot. However, it is normal for this time of year.
Mm-hmm. What about at Lake County, Whitney? I should note, too, that sound you're hearing is there's a little bit of scuffling going on with the two kittens here. But what are you seeing as far as sort of bigger picture trends, Whitney?
So our intake is also just, it's very standard. We take in a little over 6,000 animals a year, so not as many as Orange County, but our population is much smaller. Mm-hmm. So you expect to see an increase in your animal intake through Animal Services as your population grows. And so that's just a function of, you know, growth in general. We have seen almost identical intake over, you know, last year as well. Mm-hmm. So there's nothing out of the ordinary going on. However, because we have made a commitment to be a no-kill community, we have to try that much harder to place, you know, just as many animals.
Thinking about animals that you have a lot of at one time, like pigs, for example, are they pet pigs? Are they escaping from farms? Where are they coming from?
So the ones we have right now are all pot bellies. So they may have been the result of a family thinking, oh, this is such a cute little pig. And then before you know it, it's 200 pounds and it's not so cute anymore.
It's eating a lot.
Yeah. And there's, you know, the social media, people see all these adorable pictures of these baby pigs and they think it's a great idea. And then it turns out not to be such a great idea when your HOA finds out that you've got a pig in your backyard.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that some of them do just get out and they're strays and they get picked up. And then other people, I think, unfortunately, discard them when they can't handle them any longer.
Diane, what about yourself? Are you noticing some animal trends this year that you haven't seen in previous years?
It's been pretty routine for us. We deal primarily in dogs and cats, so there are certain dog breeds that we see continually over time, probably like bully breed mixes, occasionally huskies as well. They're very popular in this area.
Mm-hmm.
So those probably more so than any other breed are what we would consider a trend.
And then what about exotic animals? Like, say, somebody gets a certain kind of lizard or a snake or something. How do you deal with that?
So we actually recently responded to a Walmart over on Chickasaw Trail that had a beautiful parrot loose in that store. So in a case like that, we rely on our wildlife partners, such as Back to Nature and Fallen Pines, to assist because our shelter is equipped to house dogs and cats, mm-hmm. but not our exotics. And that bird actually did end up going over to Fallen Pines and was reclaimed by its owner.
And is Fallen Pines like a, is it essentially a shelter for other kinds of animals other than dogs and cats?
Yes, and it's out in Christmas. So it's on the east side of Orange County, and the woman who runs it, Shirley, does a wonderful job. She helps all types of animals, and she's a great resource for us at our shelter.
So thinking about partnerships, Whitney, I understand that you have a plan to try and create a little bit of a sort of a network of shelters in Florida for when you hit capacity, like summer months, I guess would be a good time to be thinking about reaching out to other shelters if you don't have space for certain animals. Tell me a little bit about what's going on there.
We recently decided we were going to host an animal shelter leadership symposium, and it's going to take place in August, and we have invited pretty much every public animal shelter leader in the state to come and join us. So far, we've had 13 counties say that they're on board, and we'd love to talk about our common challenges, solutions, what's working, what's not working in our area, and how we can help one another.
And that would include if one shelter has space and another doesn't, you might be able to shift some animals around.
What's really interesting is that there's a supply and demand in animal sheltering, right? And so there are different populations with different preferences and different desires. And so it's entirely possible that we could have a neighboring county that has no difficulty at all adopting out, like, hounds, for example. Maybe people in that county, they just think they're adorable. Whereas for us, hounds might be a little bit more difficult to place. So there's no reason that we couldn't work together, maybe do some trading and some common networking to get those animals into new homes.
Diane Summers, what are your thoughts on the kind of network of shelters idea or sort of pooling resources?
It is interesting how, you know, just over a couple counties or potentially over states, the supply and demand does vary so greatly. For example, we have pulled dozens of cats from Sebring Animal Services, which is about 2 hours south of Orange County. They have a number of healthy, friendly cats, but in their county, they don't have necessarily the population to find adopters for those cats. But here in Orange, we have a lot of foot traffic here at our shelter, so we're able to help them out. Mm-hmm. So each county has potentially a little bit different of a strength and weakness. So I love the idea of working together so that we can, you know, potentially move some animals around in an effort to find them ideal placement.
I want to just finish up by asking both of you, Diane and Whitney, just some kind of tips for people who are thinking about getting a pet or interested in adopting, or just some ideas about pet management, so to speak. Diane, you want to start us off? What would you say to folks who are interested in getting a pet and thinking about going to the shelter to see what's available?
Sure. I always recommend checking out the local animal shelters. For anyone who's even just thinking about getting a pet in the future, it's always good to just check out the shelters, get a lay of the land, you know, meet some of the staff, check out the available animals. You never know who's going to catch your eye and you'll fall in love with. Sometimes people come to our shelter having seen a pet online and think that's the one for them, but unexpectedly one will catch their eye as they're walking through and they just know, that's my baby. Mm-hmm. So we, you know, welcome anyone and everyone to our shelter here. And even if somebody is interested in helping pets but not necessarily able to make a long-term commitment, we do have a foster care program here that we are actively recruiting members to. I'm a foster parent through the shelter. You can help kittens and puppies primarily by just taking them in for a couple weeks and helping them get to an age where they're ready for adoption. And every pet fostered is a life saved, and, you know, you get a couple weeks, TLC, and you've helped that animal get to the next chapter of their lives.
Whitney Boylston, what's your advice to people considering getting a pet?
I 100% agree. Come to the shelter, make your public animal shelter your number one stop when you're looking to add to your family, and come with an open mind. Diane said, you just don't know who is going to, you know, spark your fancy and you're just going to have to cuddle in love with. So definitely come down, check out all of our available pets online, but when you come to the shelter, you're going to want to meet them in person. And then also we have a foster program, a volunteer program. There are so many ways to get involved and to help local animals. And we just encourage anybody who loves pets to join our team.
You would want to do your homework before you make that trip, though. Make sure your house is set up for it and you know what you're getting into.
Absolutely. Pets are a lifetime commitment. And so we definitely want people to take that in consideration and also be honest about your lifestyle. If you are a couch potato, you don't want to end up with a high-energy herding breed that's, you know, just going to drive you insane. So
what's a good couch potato animal?
Oh, there's so many. A lot of your bigger dogs, like your Great Danes, they will just, you know, lay on the couch with you all day. And then the retired hunting dogs, you know, they just know, okay, that part of their life is over and they're ready to relax.
Whitney Boylston is the director of the Lake County Office of Animal Services. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
You're also joined by Diane Summers with the Orange County Animal Services. Diane, thank you as well.
Thank you.
Support for Intersection comes from Florida Hospital and from our listeners. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. The executive producer is Catherine Welch. Our intern is Brenda Argetta. We're online at wmfe.org/intersection. Find us on the NPR One app. Download the podcast from iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Matthew Petty. Follow me on Twitter at Matthew_Petty. And thanks for listening.